and with such interest bodes very well for our country, and I'm delighted to see you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Penny, not only for your introduction, but for your willingness to run as a delegate committed to me in the Illinois primary in 1972. And I think anybody who offers to do that ought to have some time to explain why. It may take some explanation. First of all, let me apologize to all of you for being late. I was here in the building on time, but I had to listen. Oh, I think I was, 7:30? But I was listening to the President of the United States. No, really, the President, as you know, or maybe some of you don't, had asked for television time to make a statement on Vietnam, and I thought it was important that I should hear it before I came to you so that if it seemed appropriate, I could comment on what he had to say. And so that's what I've been doing, and I will try to do that as part of what I say to you this evening. I know you've been crowded into this room and impatient, and I understand that. But that did seem to me important to do. It is good to be here in Southern Illinois and on the campus of this university. I've had many occasions in the last 3 years, beginning with the campaign of 1968, to talk to students and with them and to listen to them. I think the number of such campuses must exceed 100 by now. And I always enjoy it. And I suppose that the quality I like about these meetings, even though it is at the same time uncomfortable, is the quality of impatience, which pervades student views and student attitudes about our government, our country, its policies, our values, because I think that kind of impatience on your part does have the effect of stimulating us eventually to respond. I'm delighted to see the references to Adlai in this room. And I'd like to tell a story that his father used to enjoy telling on himself years ago, to strike the note which I'd like to strike for a few moments. It was that none of you probably remember what an eloquent and stimulating speaker Adlai Stevenson was. It was my privilege to campaign for him in 1952 in Maine, when it was dangerous for any Democrat to raise his head above the crowd in my state. And I was able to persuade a great many citizens of Maine to support him because of his qualities. And he had an inspirational quality that was really unique. And I remember the story that he used to tell of the reaction to one of his speeches, when an enthusiast in the back of the room jumped to his feet and said, "Governor, every thinking man and woman in America will vote for you." And Stevenson said, "Well, I'm sorry, that isn't good enough. I need a majority." I would be interested to see the elder Adlai's reaction to the troubled times in which we live. May I say just a word about the president's speech tonight? And it was an important one. It told us a lot of things that will give us food for thought and study for the next few days as we try to evaluate the fresh information that he has given us. Basically, what he undertook to do was to explain what had been going on in private channels, private negotiations, while he has been president, in Paris. He made the point that there's been a public dialogue, but there's also been a private dialogue between his representatives and the representatives of our government in Paris with respect to a negotiated settlement. There have been, according to what he told us, 12 meetings or 12 trips, which were taken by Mr. Kissinger, beginning with August 4th, 1969, and continuing through last year. He gave us simply a resume of what those trips involved. And then he said that on November 11th, I think it was, yes, October 11th of last year, his representatives presented a plan for settlement to the other side, that on October 25th, the North Vietnamese agreed to meet on November 21st to discuss that plan, that on November 17th, or 4 days before the expected meeting, the North Vietnamese advised our delegation that Le Duc Tho, the chief North Vietnamese delegate, was ill and could not meet on November 21st, that no other date was subsequently agreed to, and that the plan which had been offered by us on October 11th has in effect been ignored by the other side. The president further said that that plan, with some new elements which he didn't identify, would be presented publicly this Thursday in this Thursday scheduled meeting of the negotiators in Paris. And that plan, and I'm now reading my own shorthand and it may not be accurate, that plan includes these elements: the withdrawal of all our forces within 6 months after agreement. Let me finish the rest. Secondly, the return of all prisoners of war. Three, a ceasefire throughout Indochina, including Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. A proposal for a new presidential election in South Vietnam under international supervision. And finally, he communicated an offer by President Thieu that he and his vice president, if such an election were agreed to, and if such a settlement were agreed to, that he and his vice president would resign 1 month before such a new election. There are other elements to the plan, and I don't have all the details here. So I've been trying within the 10 or 15 minutes since the president's speech was concluded to digest the implications of this proposal. Now, obviously, we all welcome a new initiative on the part of our government to settle the war and to bring our men home and to end the fighting. And I would hope that this new initiative would constitute a sound and useful basis now for the resumption of meaningful negotiations in Paris and a settlement of the war. And I would hope that the other side would respond in that spirit. Questions occur, I think, with respect to the possibilities of the other side agreeing to this proposal. One such question is with respect to the proposal for a ceasefire throughout Indochina. Most of the discussion of a ceasefire up to now has been limited to a ceasefire in Vietnam to permit the safe withdrawal of our troops. To offer a ceasefire throughout Indochina, of course, affects the situation in Cambodia and Laos as well as Vietnam. And I think it is a matter of record that Le Duc Tho expressly rejected that kind of an overall ceasefire last year. Nevertheless, I think, from my point of view, it is reassuring that we should at last be making a proposal to withdraw by a date certain all of our forces in Vietnam in exchange for our prisoners of war. And incidentally, the president added this to what he had to say. The plan, as I hope I've reported it accurately, the plan as he presented it included a political settlement, obviously, because it includes an election in South Vietnam. But he said in addition that if the Vietnamese people on both sides preferred to settle their political differences themselves, then he was perfectly willing to talk about the withdrawal of our forces and a ceasefire separately from the political initiatives that are included in his proposal. Well, that is the plan. I think we'll all be interested to study the details of what has taken place since August 4th, 1969, so that we can evaluate the positions taken by both sides with respect to initiatives, proposals, new ideas, new efforts to settle the war. What we all want, of course, is an end to the war. And I would hope, and indeed I would pray, that this initiative would be successful and that long before the elections of next fall, our involvement in the war would be ended and our boys would be home. That is the result that we really want. So I would hope that the president's initiative this Thursday would be the basis for a positive response on the other side, and if there are sticking points, that those will be negotiated in a spirit of, on both sides, of achieving a settlement of the fighting. And I think you'll agree that it was worth taking a little time to listen to this speech tonight so that I might at least have some impression of what's going on in the outside world while I meet with you here on the campus of Southern Illinois University. And I meant no reflection upon the campus of Southern Illinois University. Well, I did not come here to make a long prepared speech. I did have a preliminary statement, which I now discard because my principal objective was to say something at the outset to stimulate your thinking and then open up this meeting to questions and answers. I find that the most useful way to engage in a dialogue with Americans, and especially young Americans. And so I'd like, in just a moment or two, to invite you in on this conversation. I'd like to say just something about the thought that Penny expressed. This is an election in which young Americans from the age of 18 up will have a chance to become involved. I know that many young Americans in 1968 rejected that opportunity as a meaningless exercise. Their argument was that there was no real choice in 1968. Well, I think many of them now are having second thoughts about that decision in 1968 as they consider some of the directions our national policies have taken and some of the things that have taken place since 1968. the problems which face us, not only abroad in Southeast Asia, but here at home, are such that they will not yield to settlement in the ways that we would consider sound and right unless we all participate and make the choices that are available to us, and indeed beyond that, to shape the choices that are available to us. The Democratic Party in the last 3 years has gone through an exercise which is unprecedented in our national political history within my lifetime, and indeed, I think, over at least the last half century. We've undertaken, not out of the steam that the establishment itself generated, but in response to the restlessness and unhappiness of so many Americans, to open up our political processes and to try to make them responsive to the needs and the voices of our people. Now, whether or not that exercise comes out right, whether or not it is implemented to the full, whether or not it produces the changes in priorities and direction that so many Americans urge upon me and others who are seeking the presidency this year, will depend in large part upon the extent to which you are willing to become involved. And that has to be something more than voting. And it certainly has to be something more than voting in the general election next fall. Here in Illinois, you have an opportunity to get involved in your Illinois primary. There are two phases to it: the selection of delegates to the Democratic National Convention, and also the expression of a presidential preference. Not across the board, because not all of my rivals have entered the Illinois primary. But at least you have a chance to express a preference if there is one there for you. So I would hope that whatever happens to this issue of the wall in the next weeks or months, that you will become involved, that you will raise the questions, that you will examine the candidates, and that you will influence the final selection not only of the Democratic candidate, but also of the president next November. That's what it's all about. And I know from the interest you've displayed here this evening that you've got the interest. Take it on from here, and I'm sure that we can begin to come out right at the end, which is the policy-making processes of our society. Having said that, let's get into the questions and see what kind of an interesting evening we can have. I think the question was this: how do I stand on the issue of J. Edgar Hoover's retirement? Well, I think he should have retired long ago. I'm not sure I would want him to retire before January of 1973. Because I'd like to be involved in naming his successor. The question is, if the war isn't going to be an issue, what do I think is going to be the paramount issue? Well, I think the simple answer to that would be that the war isn't the only problem that we face. We have the whole question of managing our economy, how we deal with the problems of our deteriorating cities, how we deal with the problem of racial tensions, how we bring opportunity and promise into the lives of 15, 20, 25 million Americans who've been outside the area of promise in the American society for too long. I mean, to get our people once more committed to the potential of our society, to believe in it and to use it and to build upon it in order to build a healthier, more wholesome country for all Americans, I think, is the supreme challenge of our time. Now, the war has diverted us, and diverted us tragically and massively from this objective. And so ending the war has been important in order to permit us to get back to the main task of building a good society here at home. But the problems existed before. They existed in the 40s and the 50s. We didn't altogether perceive them in those years because they hadn't reached the level of visibility for many Americans. For instance, the drug culture didn't trouble most Americans until it moved out of the ghetto. But the problem existed in the ghetto for years, outside of the view of many of us. The same is true, of course, of the living conditions in American ghettos. They didn't come to our attention until the cities began to burn in 66, 67. But the basic causes, the basic problems, which ultimately led to that expression of discontent on the part of many Americans, existed before. So we have a massive job to do. Now, with respect to the more conventional political issues, I think the economy is going to be an issue. The president's management of the economy in the last 3 years has been a disaster and has squeezed us. And in the course of the evening, we may get into some of the details, but I think I don't want to filibuster one question. We'll go on to some others. The question is, what is my view toward amnesty for those young men who've gone to Canada? Or anywhere.
How about in jail?
Or in jail. I think that repatriation of these young men must be an objective of national policy when the war is ended, when the fighting and the dying has ended in Vietnam for our boys. At that point, I think we consider that and the terms upon which we ought to base it, as well as the problems of other young men who've been caught up in the war and its problems and the draft. Young men who've gone to Vietnam, many of them protesting the war. Some of them died, some of them returned with their lives interrupted, their education interrupted, some returning with the drug problem. I mean, all of these young people have been caught up in the war, and we must address ourselves compassionately and objectively to all of them when the war is over. I think when it is over, we can then address ourselves to those problems objectively. But I'm not prepared to pick out one group now for particular treatment at this point. The young man in back. Wait, I can't. May I hear this question? I'll try to get back to the other one. Well, I could be facetious and say that depends on what state I'm in. Let me say this, seriously. You know, to have reached that point in my thinking would be, I think, quite presumptuous, because it's not clear yet that I'm going to be making that choice. Nevertheless, I have tried to indicate that I have just two criteria that I think are overriding. First of all, I would want my vice presidential running mate to be qualified to be president. That's rather obvious, although it hasn't been through much of our history. Secondly, I think the vice presidential candidate ought to represent continuity in policy. And that certainly hasn't been true through much of our history. Now, thirdly, let me say that in the ranks of the Democratic Party, there are outstanding possible candidates for the vice presidency. Adlai Stevenson, your own senator, is an obvious inclusion in any list of possible vice presidential candidates. There are many others. So I don't think that, you know, we're going to face a barren field. And I think in terms of people like Adlai Stevenson, Harold Hughes, Fritz Mondale, Tom Eagleton, so many more. Now, when you begin listing names, then you get into trouble. but so many more in very positive terms, and I haven't narrowed the field yet, and I must say that it tends to grow. What steps should be taken, and more importantly, what would I do about pollution in the country? What was that again? What have I done? Well, I think the two landmark pieces of legislation that can really begin to come to grips with the problem are the Air Quality Act of last year and the water pollution legislation that we passed through the Senate before the Congress adjourned or recessed last year. Both of these include the money, or at least the authorization for the money and the tough enforcement policies and the standards, which if implemented fully, can begin to turn us around. For example, in the Water Pollution Act, which we passed in the Senate, we set a goal in three phases. The ultimate goal is to eliminate all discharges into our waterways. Now, whether or not that's going to be feasible 100% is a question that we will need to decide in the next 14 years. But in the interim, by 1975, we set a target goal that must be met. 1981, another target goal, and this potential goal in 1985. Now, this, for the first time, gets at the problem by directing public policy, including enforcement, at the actual discharges into our waterways. And unless we do that, we're not going to come to grips with the problem. Now, to do that is going to require a massive investment of public money, private funds, as well as effective enforcement at all three levels of government. You know, I've been involved in writing laws 13 years now in the Congress, and before that in a legislature. And I'm cynical enough about the whole process to know that no matter how tough your language is, no matter how apparently effective it may be, that it doesn't really have an impact unless it's administered effectively. And so I've given you what the language is, but whether it's administered effectively will depend upon the extent to which people all over the country understand what it is that we're asking and support it. Because to do, an effective job in dealing with environmental problems is going to require drastic changes in the ways we live, in the ways we build cities, in the ways we produce goods, and where we do. That, you know, in a country of 200 million people, which is the most industrialized and sophisticated society on the face of the planet, isn't going to be easy. It's going to change the ways we move about. It's going to change the ways in which we build, for the increasing population that we face. So it's going to be a massive change. But I think we've laid the basis in these two. Now, we wrote legislation before that, and we tried to make it as tough as we could, given the public opinion we had to work with. Now, I think we've got a more aroused public. We've tried to write these tougher laws. I didn't narrow any choice. I wasn't making a choice. What I was stating was what I believed to be a fact. That is that the country isn't prepared to support a ticket with a black as a vice presidential running mate. I hope I'm wrong. And it is wrong that this should be so if it is. And I commit myself to changing that. But when we consider the election of this year, it isn't a simple yes or no kind of a thing. I think the principal objective should be to defeat President Nixon because his policies are wrong, and I say this from the point of view of black Americans as well as white Americans. Now, what I said to that group in Los Angeles, and this was a group of black leaders in the Watts area of Los Angeles, who met at my request and who asked for a frank discussion of black grievances, black potentials, and what we could do effectively to deal with them. It was in that context of what we could do effectively to deal with them that I was asked, well, would it be possible to consider this in 1972? My answer was that if what you want to do is to maximize the chances for defeating President Nixon and changing the policies that bear upon the lives of black Americans and others who are discriminated against in our society, then I don't think that would be possible. But I wasn't making a decision with respect to who would be my running mate or what my preference would be. I was undertaking to underline what I believe to be the fact of black political inequality, just as I think there is black educational inequality, black economic inequality, black inequality with respect to places to work, places to live, and health care, among other things. And all these other inequalities, you know, have been drummed home to us over and over again by the Kerner Commission report, by other reports. Yet, when I raised that one, you know, for some reason, that was unacceptable. I understand why. Nobody likes to be told that they're not equal. But when inequality spreads throughout our society in so many ways, I think the only way to come to grips with that inequality, to deal with it effectively and to change it, is to understand it and identify it and work against it. You say, why? Well, the fact that why is there inequality in any aspect of American life today? I mean, you can mark advances for every minority group. You know, there are a lot of tickets that you could put together that wouldn't have as good a chance as other tickets that you could put together with respect to electability. That's always been recognized. I mean, blacks have a peculiar problem because, you know, their origins in America are different than the origins of any of the rest of us.
Yeah, they're in Africa.
That's right, and they came here as slaves. The rest of us, or our forebears, came here freely at least, but not blacks. So you started from a lower level of, lower status in society than the rest of us who have also had to fight in one way or another for equality. Well, if you wouldn't mind my answering one question at a time, I think that we might make progress a little better. No, this young black here has put me a question. I think he's entitled to an answer. You're asking me why. Well, the whys are all the wrong reasons. We understand that. They're all the wrong reasons. But it's also wrong that a black child has a 90% you know, better chance of dying before his first birthday than a white. Why about that? That's for the wrong reason. Or that a black child doesn't have equal educational opportunity. You can ask why there, and that's the wrong reason. The why, the answer to the why is the wrong reason. And I can't advocate, I can't present those reasons very effectively or very eloquently because I don't believe in them. But the fact of inequality is here. I think that we pushed it back. I think we've made some progress, but we've got a long way to go, and I'm for making that trip.
Senator Muskie, if you are representing the moral leadership of our country as President of the United States, don't you think you have an obligation to be in the forefront of any move to change the way society views minorities in this country?
I agree with that, so let me ask you a question. He said, don't I, as a leader then, have an obligation to be in the forefront of those who are trying to break down inequality? All right, let me ask you, which inequality would you want me to tackle first in 72? Let me ask, which one first? You know, which question do you want to test? Do you want to test the electability of a black vice president? Which war do you want fought this year? That one? Or do you want to fight the war of black inequality in these other areas?
I think it should be done all at once.
That would be fine. It would be fine if you can do it all at once. I'd have no objection to winning every battle at once, if it can be done. If it can be done.
I don't want to monopolize the time. I think I should
do it. Well, I wouldn't worry if this question monopolized all of our time, because I think I think it's the most crucial question in American life today. how we eliminate inequality. And how do we do it effectively? How do we proceed? What should be our priorities? What should we hit first? Can we do it all at once? If we could do it all at once, believe me, I'd fight to do it all at once.
I realize that quite a few people have asked you questions already on this particular question of lack of running mate, but when you first were speaking about a running mate, you said you had two criteria. And based on those two criteria, they were qualifications to be a running mate. And inequality or inequality was not one of them. So how can you bring in the basis of inequality if a person is qualified? If a person is qualified, why doesn't he have every right to be on a platform to run?
Well, he has every right.
But you can't accept that?
We're not discussing my preferences. I've expressed none with this respect. What I was trying to do, because I knew the issue was developing, what realistic view do you take of this question? Look, I was speaking to a group of blacks. Don't you think I know what answer might have pleased them? I didn't bring them together, ask them to meet with me for the purpose of turning them off. I asked them to meet with me so that they could get to know me, know whether I'm direct, honest, to be followed, to be believed, whether or not I understood their problems and so on. I wasn't there to insult them. I was there to try to discuss black grievances in a frank and honest way. Now, it's difficult for us politicians to be honest. I concede that point. you come into a group like this and you get one point of view over here, another one here, another one there, another one in that corner, and you can't please them all. So how do you wend your way through an evening like this? By doing the best you can to say what you believe. Now, if you think that, the political inequality of blacks is irrelevant to the picking of a ticket next year from the point of view of blacks themselves, all right, that's a conclusion you reach. I don't think it is irrelevant. And I think you have to take it into account. If after taking it into account and the dialogue has started, that's all I said, that it wasn't irrelevant. If after taking into account, one side or another, one party or another decides, that this is the issue to be tested next year, fine. I've fought losing elections and elections I knew were going to be lost, and I can do it again if that's what we want to do. Risk losing an election to test that particular question rather than change a whole climate of policymaking in Washington. Now, that's the question to be considered. Now, your answer may be different than mine, but I don't think it's irrelevant to consider the question.
Last October 5th, Senator Gravel announced an amendment, the Fourth Amendment, to stop funds from bombing of Indochina. You voted no on that amendment. I'm curious as to why.
The reason was, the question was that on the Gravel Amendment of last fall, which would have prohibited the spending of any funds for any bombing at all in Indochina. Let me make these points. First, for 2 years, no, I'll get to that one, but I want you to get it in the context of my thinking. First, I've supported every effort, every amendment, every proposal, whether it was called a McGovern-Hatfield or Hatfield-McGovern or Mansfield or Cooper Church, and introduced my own. End the war by a date certain. Now, what bothered me about the Gravel Amendment was that if we were to pursue that way to do it, given the present dispositions of what appeared to be our policy in Washington, that what we might do is slow down the withdrawal of our troops in Indochina for the reason that It seemed clear to me that the administration was substituting air power for land power or for manpower as they withdrew our forces from Vietnam. And if we took away that instrument, it might commit them to a slower withdrawal rate. In other words, I just didn't see that as an effective way to end our involvement in South Vietnam. It seemed to me that the most direct and simple one was the one that, you know, we won several times in the Senate, and that is to set a date for withdrawal. Then we discontinue bombing, we discontinue fighting on ground, naval warfare, we discontinue the whole bit. In other words, I didn't see that as a viable way of ending the war.
Yes, sir, but one more statement. The fact is the administration has continued the bombing, and maybe if the Senate could have pushed over a vote, they wouldn't be bombing those peasants now.
Look, in the Senate, we've passed the Mansfield Amendment three times, I think. We've come close to passing the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment. None of those efforts dissuaded the administration, because the administration's always been able to stop us in the conference between the House and the Senate. They would have done the same thing to the Gravel Amendment. The Safe Streets Act of 1968, creates a broad enough authority to include not only the strengthening of local police forces, but also the improvement of our prison systems and the improvement of our court systems and other aspects of law enforcement. And I felt that we should proceed in all of these areas with sufficient funds to do the total job. Now, the emphasis of this administration, I think, has been too narrow, and I think it should be broadened to include these other aspects. Then now we're talking simply about the law enforcement side of the problem. Of course, there is the other side of the problem, which are all these social problems that give rise to unrest in our society. But on the purely law enforcement side, these are the elements that I just don't think the tough talk or that the dilution of constitutional liberties through such means as no-knock or preventive detention are the way to deal with this problem. I think you need well-trained and effective law enforcement agencies. I think you need to reform our prison systems, and you certainly need to reform our court systems as well. You see, I don't want to neglect the other side of the room. Yes, I've been conducting hearings. I'm chairman of the Arms Control Subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee, and I've been conducting hearings to prod our government into this into this policy direction, to discontinue all testing, and to take the initiative to straw that first.
Senator Muskie's aides have indicated he has time for only one more question, and then he has to leave.
Well, before we take this one question, let me. I've got to go to Kentucky tonight, and then I've got to go to Washington early tomorrow morning to vote on an important civil rights measure. And if I'm to meet that schedule, I can't stay here all night. I apologize. I'll be back, but I'll take this question. The question is, our present government programs include subsidies for big business. What would I do for small business, and what would I do for the farmer? Well, this question could keep me here quite a while, too. With respect to to small business throughout my Senate career. I've supported programs to provide assistance, including forms of subsidy, to small business. Those can be improved and refined, and I think need to be. With respect to the farmer, I think what the farmer needs is consideration for his price problem. I think that we ought to move in the direction of collective bargaining for farmers with respect to the prices they get in the marketplace. I think we need to adopt legislation to limit the expansion of corporate farming. I think we need to adopt legislation and policies to restrict the concentration of land ownership in a few hands. I think that's a dangerous trend, not only for the farmer, but for the country as well.